What is flavor? In my humble opinion, flavor is anything that enhances life experiences. Last month, we discussed flavor in the terms of food, fashion, and local entertainment. And on Valentine's Day next week, I want to look at another thing that enhances our lives, our relationships. Relationship guru Esther Perel stated that the quality of your relationships determines the quality of your life. This is Nicole from the North Carolina Reading Service, and I'll be reading from the following articles that have been shortened due to the time constraints of this segment. The first article is, Our Family Fell Out, and This is How We Got Back Together. Second, The Friendship Recession, The Lost Art of Connecting. Third, What New Love Does to Your Brain. And last, Why Modern Love is So Damn Hard. Through these articles, we will examine the quality of our family, bonds, friendships, new love, and long-term romantic relationships. We often think of family as something permanent, but families, like any other relationship, are living systems. They stretch, fracture, fall silent, and sometimes fall apart. And yet, family is often where we formulate our understanding of love. This first piece reminds us that the love within families isn't always perfect or even permanent. This article will explore what happens when a family falls out and what it takes to reconcile. Thus, Our Family Fell Out, This is How We Got Back Together by Kirstie Brewer, January 31st, 2026. When Jordan Lux blocked her mom's phone number and deleted her from social media, she was resolute about them never speaking again. Such was the hurt and resentment that Jordan, who was 25 at the time, felt towards her mom. The pair were estranged for almost 3 years, but eventually managed to tread a long and delicate path back into one another's lives. Jordan and her mother, Dani Ackerman, offer a rare both sides perspective on family breakdown and what it takes to reconcile. It's taken 6 years of slowly learning, having fights, hanging up the phone angry, and not being able to communicate properly, says Jordan, now 33, speaking from her home in California. She is joined on a call by Dani, 59, in Las Vegas, who is very candid about how much she messed up and wasn't there for her daughter. An ongoing feud within the Beckham family finally exploded into open in the late January, fueling debates about adult children had going no contact with their parents. Brooklyn Beckham posted on Instagram that he does not want to reconcile with his parents, whom he said have controlled and emotionally manipulated him throughout his life. His parents have not commented. There is relatively little research on estrangement, but studies from Germany and United States suggest more common than not. About 1 in 4 American adults are estranged from at least one family member, according to a study by sociologist Dr. Carl Pillemer, who leads Cornell University's Family Estrangement and Reconciliation Project. He also conducted in-depth interviews with 100 people who have repaired family rifts. He is keen to make clear that sometimes people were estranged for a good reason and for whom seeking reconciliation was not the right choice. For example, individuals who have endured emotional abuse, chronic disrespect, or relationships so draining that continuing contact threatens their well-being. The key is making that decision thoughtfully, with self-awareness rather than in the heat of anger, so you can live with it peacefully going forward. Estrangement is on the rise because younger generations have a broader language for what counts as parental harm and trauma, according to psychologist Dr. Joshua Coleman, who specializes in family estrangement and reconciliation, having experienced both with his own daughter. He explains that younger generations are more comfortable in asserting their needs and boundaries. Today, really, every letter I see from an estranged adult child says, I have to do this to protect my mental health. Parents need to take an approach to conflict with their children that is careful and curious, interested and empathetic, he adds. This is really the first generation of parents who've had to do this kind of work. This requires shift in mindset has proven challenging and missed Dani. At first, it felt like she was trying to change me and I just wanted to be accepted. I think that's where our battles have come from. At whatever age, cutting ties with a parent is rarely done lightly and always stems from emotional hurt and wounds that haven't been addressed. Jordan traces her own harm back to her childhood. She did not feel at the time, but she was living on fault lines of an ugly custody battle between her parents, who both went on to remarry. This and the turbulent years that followed took its toll on her mental health and her ability to form secure relationships, she says. It felt as though my mom only wanted to be part of my good parts and didn't want to discuss the bad ones. For Danny, who says being Jordan's mom was a joy, is painful to hear. Both agree they struggled to establish relationships within and emotional connections as adults. The final straw for Jordan came in 2017. I decided to cut off contact with my mom when she told me about her divorce to my stepdad and wanted sympathy from me. At the time, I was still mad that she didn't leave him sooner, she says, explaining she felt her mom always put her partner above Jordan's own well-being. Estrangement is often described by therapists as a living or ambiguous loss, as they grieve a loved one who is still alive but whom the relationship has ended. For parents, there will be a fear of judgment. What have you done to bring this on, says Dr. Lucy Blake, a senior lecturer in psychology at the University of West England and author of No Family's Perfect, A Guide to Embracing the Messy Reality. It can be particularly a stigmatized experience for women, especially women of a certain generation where motherhood may be central to their identity. Danny tried to keep busy and hold on to the hope that her daughter might come back around. Almost 3 years passed, and then, out of the blue, Jordan's number flashed up on her phone. She picked up immediately. Jordan had left her relationship and begun to see a therapist who had caused her to ruminate over her estrangement from her mom. I felt elated. I got to be there and be her mom again, said Danny. It would be several years, however, until she didn't feel that she was walking on eggshells, terrified that she might put a foot wrong and have her daughter leave again. It's hard to have your children tell you the things that you do are wrong with you. It's hard to have your adult children tell you the things that are wrong with you as a parent, she says. It's so painful, but I was ready. I wanted to be a better mom. The number of adult children and their parents who reconcile is hard to know, but the factors behind success stories are strikingly consistent in Cornell's research, says Pillemer. Those who managed to reconcile were the parents who could let go of their need for their adult child to apologize or agree on past events and instead focus on building a future relationship. Critically, they also engage in genuine self-examination about their own role in the estrangement, moving past what I call defensive ignorance. That is, where people claim to have no idea why the rift occurred while simultaneously listing a history of conflicts, says Pillemer. Sending a letter or an email to your estranged child could be a way to broach the subject of reconciliation, say some therapists. The language should be open and non-accusatory. That letter needs to be sent with the willingness to listen and hear that there may be other possibilities outside of the story I am telling. In some cases, reconciliation might be partial, being able to go to the same family functions and be civil, for example, or it may not be possible at all. For Danny and Jordan, there were three crucial steps to reconciling: not being defensive, realizing that reconciliation might take place and take time, and understanding there need to be boundaries. Jordan is now happily married and has become a parent herself. She's moving house soon, and Danny will be flying in to help pack her daughter's life in boxes. They will have fun along the way, says Jordan. Before now, I couldn't imagine wanting her around during a stressful time. Now I'm so thankful that she can come. If family is love we inherit, friendship is the love we choose. And yet, in recent years, something subtle but profound has shifted. Experts have begun to name this phenomenon as the friendship recession. The next piece asks us to reflect on the idea of friendships not as something casual or optional, but something that is vital, that requires attention, and most importantly, effort. Thus, The Friendship Recession, The Lost Art of Connecting, by Carolyn Bruckman of Harvard Kennedy School, and her contributing editors were Bryce Fillmore, Senior Research Associate, as well as Ryan Meekin, Associate Research Fellow of the Leadership and Happiness Laboratory. The so-called friendship recession is making its way into vernacular, a profound shift in how Americans experience and sustain friendships. The data paints a stark picture. According to America's Perspective Survey, the percentage of United States adults who report having no friends has quadrupled to 12% since 1990, while the percentage of those with 10 or more close friends have fallen by nearly threefold. The foundations of this crisis were laid long before the lockdown. For decades, Americans consistently spent 6.5 hours a week with friends. Then between 2014 and 2019, that number plummeted to 4 hours per week. To be sure, systemic forces underlie the shift. Suburban sprawl has physically distanced us from one another. The government slowed down in its investments in construction of third spaces, such as community centers, parks, and coffee shops, which have left fewer places for organic social interactions. The rise of gig economy and economic pressures have made free time a luxury. These factors have made friendship more difficult, and policymakers, urban planners, and venture capitalists are searching for solutions. However, these structural forces alone can't account for the larger shift. If inaccessibility were the primary driver, we wouldn't see relatively stable connection rates among older adults over the last several years. If wealthier individuals have more access to communal spaces, why has solo dining increased by 29% in the last 2 years? If this was purely circumstantial, why would Stanford now offer Design for Healthy Friendships, a class dedicated to helping its students structure their social lives with intention? These trends point to something more insidious, a cultural crisis. As Anne Helen Peterson writes, time for friendship is a privilege, but it's also a matter of priorities. The way we spend our time, whom we invest in, and what we prioritize is shifting. Solitude is becoming more than a preference, it's becoming a default. And when not used well, the result of solitude isn't just fewer friendships, it's a fundamental loss in the ability to form and sustain them. If we don't consciously reshape our priorities and relearn how to cultivate meaningful relationships, we risk a future where connections, one of the most fundamental sources of happiness and well-being, fade into the backgrounds of our lives. Thus, the culture shift. Number one, work has become a dominant social identity. It's often said that if you ask an American what they do, they'll tell you about their job, whereas a European might talk about their hobbies and passions. Data backs this up. United States workers put in an average of 1,799 hours per year. For an example, 77% of Americans work more than 40 hours per week if you take their full paid leave. Pew Research suggests that the percentage of adults 65 and older who are employed has nearly doubled since 1987, rising from 11% to 19%. These shifts are in part driven by broader economic forces. Higher costs of living and stagnating wages for low and middle income earners mean that everyday Americans must work harder to keep up. However, these shifts suggest a deeper cultural transformation may be occurring, one where the old American ethos of working hard and climbing the economic ladder has evolved into an all-consuming, identity-defining pursuit that leaves little room for much else. In a study of generational shifts in work values in the United States, researchers found that Americans are placing greater importance on intrinsic work values, such as having interesting jobs and work that helps others and society. Finding meaning in work obviously isn't a problem per se. Yet, when finding fulfillment in work comes at the expense of meaningful personal relationships, it becomes a problem, one that risks leaving individuals fulfilled in their careers but isolated in their personal lives. Second, the focus is increasingly on the nuclear family. As work has become increasingly all-encompassing, Americans have doubled down on prioritizing their families, particularly their children, over friendships. One 2013 Pew Research study found that 49% of parents report spending more time with their children than their own parents did. These trends reflect a cultural shift towards intensive parenting. A child's achievements are an extension of their parents' competence, which fuels an arm of overscheduling, constant supervision, and exhaustive emotional labor. This model of parenting leaves little room for adult friendships, as socializing is increasingly deprioritized in favor of ensuring one child gets ahead. Simultaneously, Americans are spending less time engaged in activities and groups in their communities. The rate of volunteering has steeply declined since the early 2000s. Some research suggests that while almost 30% of Americans reported volunteering in 2005, only 23% report volunteering in 2021. The American Survey Center found that 15% of Americans belong to neighborhoods associations and only 10% are members of sports leagues. This decline in community involvement mirrors a broader shift away from the organized religion. Pew Research suggests that the percentage of Americans who don't identify with any faith has grown from 17 to 20% over a decade. These institutions were once the glue that held social networks together, places where friendships naturally form through shared experiences. Taken together, these trends suggest that Americans are increasingly retreating inward instead of engaging in communal activities. Friendships is no longer seen as an integral part of daily life, but rather something we squeeze in when all of our responsibilities have been met. Third, the rise of screen time and digital-only friendships. Needless to say, the rise of internet and mobile phones have only accelerated the shift. Nearly 40% of Americans now have online-only friends. Among teenagers, this trend is even more pronounced. Teenagers are spending only 40 minutes a day in person with friends outside of school hours, down from 140 minutes a day nearly two decades ago. This culture shift would not matter if digital friendships were interchangeable with in-person friendships, but online friendships require a different set of social behaviors than in-person ones. Maintaining friendship online relies on skills like crafting the perfect message, interpreting text-based interactions, engaging in asynchronous exchanges with multiple persons at once. In contrast, in-person friendships thrive on undivided attention and are built through spontaneous moments, reading body language, and navigating the vulnerability of face-to-face connections. As Derek Thompson writes, a socially underdeveloped childhood leads to a socially stunted adulthood. In short, we're building a generation of people who do not know and may not have the ability to tolerate the messy work of forming friendships. Research also suggests that digital interactions lead to weaker connections and lower senses of mental well-being. A recent study of nearly 13,000 adults over the age of 50 found that those who engage in face-to-face interactions at least once a week experience better physical and mental well-being, whereas communication through calls or texts did not have the same effect. Neuroscience helps us to make sense of these findings. Research shows that hearing a familiar voice reduces cortisol and boosts oxytocin, the hormone tied to stress relief and bonding, while text-based communication and video calls fail to trigger the same response. Without these biological cues, digital interactions can feel strangely empty and reinforcing isolation rather than alleviating it. The neuropsychology behind why this culture shift is dangerous. Research by John Capaccio found that loneliness fuels itself. When people feel isolated, they become more sensitive to social threats and more likely to misinterpret interactions negatively through the lens of rejection. This is important because at a neurological level, social rejection doesn't just hurt emotionally. It activates the amygdala, the brain's threat detection center, and triggers the same neural pathways as physical pain. Over time, this makes socializing feel riskier, and to avoid this discomfort, we increasingly turn to psychological shortcuts. But these shortcuts and avoidances only deepen our isolation, creating a self-reinforcing cycle. The more we retreat from in-person connection, the harder it becomes, making digital interactions and solitude even more appealing. The dynamic dance of cultural change, what we need to do. It is clear that something in our culture fabric needs to change. What's less clear is how we change it. Given the dynamic dance of culture is formed and sustained, culture flows from top down through funding, zoning laws, and labor policies, but also from the bottom up through the repeated choices of individuals. As Derek Thompson points out, the more people offer convenience over community, the more businesses and institutions adapt to reinforce that behavior. If we want to push back against the friendship recession, especially against its most visceral, burgeoning societal norms, we need to actively resist the forces that make solitude the default. The key lies in strengthening the two pillars of friendship, forming and sustaining connections. Forming friendships. Embrace discomfort. Forming friendships require taking risks, and discomfort is a natural part of risk-taking. But rather than being a deterrent, novel experiences and shared challenges can be the glue that binds friendships together. Research suggests that people who go through something hard together tend to view each other more positively afterward, deepening their connection. It takes effort, a willingness to embrace uncertainty, and the courage to put yourself out there. And more often than not, the risk is worth it. Second, sustainment, making friendship a priority. Forming friendship is only half the battle. Friendship thrives on ritual and repetition. As such, sustaining them requires intentional effort, particularly in a culture that prioritizes work and family over social ties. This means making active choices to spend time with friends even when it feels inconvenient. While these prescriptions might sound easy, the reality is that culture change is hard and its effects aren't seen overnight. It would be easier to scapegoat external forces, build yet another friendship-finding app, and call it a day. While broader policy changes in social infrastructure certainly are needed and will help, we also need to recognize that change starts with us. The small daily choice we make to reach out, to show up, to invest in relationships add up to actually shape the culture we live in. And imagine what could happen if we're better together. Now we move on to romantic love. What new love does to your brain. Roses are red, violets are blue. Romance can really mess with you. By Dana G. Smith. Written February 13, 2024. New love can consume our thoughts, supercharge our emotions, and on occasion cause us to act out of character. Scientists have studied what is happening in our brains when we are in those early, heady states of infatuation and whether it can actually alter how we think and what we do. Their findings suggest that song lyrics and dramatic plot lines don't overstate it. New love can mess with our heads. Studies on prairie voles. Yes, you heard that right. Back up these findings. The rodents are one of the few mammal species that are made for life, so researchers sometimes use them for scientific models for human partnership. Studies show that when these animals pair up, the brain reward system is similarly activated, triggering the release of dopamine. Romantic love does not emanate from your cerebral cortex where you do your thinking, said Dr. Fisher, who conducted one of the first human studies on the topic at the Kinsey Institute. It's based in the brain's region linked with drive, focus, and motivation. This type of dopamine activity may explain why in the early stages of love you have the irresistible urge to be with your loved one constantly, what the addiction literature calls craving. Indeed, preliminary research conducted by Sandra Langslag, an associate professor in behavioral neuroscience at the University of Missouri at St. Louis, suggests that some people crave their lover like they crave a drug. Other research by Dr. Langslag's lab looked at single-mindedness of love, of being unable to think about anything besides your paramour. Langslag found that participants reported thinking about the object of their desire roughly 65% of their waking hours and said they had trouble focusing on unrelated topics. There is also some evidence that love can render people oblivious to a new partner's faults, the love is blind phenomenon. Lucy Brown, a professor of neuroscience at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, found that when some study participants were shown pictures of their lovers early in a relationship, they had less activity in the part of the prefrontal cortex that is important for decision-making and evaluating others. The findings suggest that we might suspend negative judgment of the person we're in love with, she said. Scientists believe humans evolved to have these types of responses, which seems to be consistent across age, gender, and culture, because bonding and mating are essential for the survival of the species. Romantic love is a drive, Dr. Fisher said. It's a basic mating drive that evolved millions of years ago to send our DNA onto tomorrow, and it can overlook just about anything. That brings us to the final article, where we'll be asked to reflect on our expectations that we demand from our romantic partners. Why Modern Love is So Damn Hard, written by Esther Perel and Mary Alice Miller, September 21, 2017. Last week, I posed a question on Facebook, why modern love is so hard. You responded with amazing reflections, questions, and stories. For today's article, I want to focus on one set of these responses. I want to speak to those of you who view commitment as a loss of self. The idea that we lose ourselves in the presence of our partner is deeply ingrained in the modern perception of love, particularly in the United States. As almost all of our communal institutions give way to this heightened sense of individualism, we look more frequently to our partner to provide the emotional and physical resources that a village or community used to provide. Is it a wonder that, tied up in relying on our partner for compassion, reassurance, sexual excitement, financial partnership, etc., that we end up looking to them for our identity, or even worse, for self-worth? Combine that with the commodification of love, the increasing omnipresent, is there somebody better? And we have a recipe for decreasing the perceived cost of love. All of this while increasing our expectations on our partnership, even adding more to the list, without really understanding what we're asking. The litany of expectation is a grand failure for a grand setup for failure. Once we strayed because marriage was not supposed to deliver love and passion, today we stray because marriage fails to deliver the love, passion, and undivided attention it promised. These expectations are extremely difficult for us to provide to one another because they are contradictory, or even in some cases, incompatible. I write in the state of affairs that contained within the small circle of the wedding band are vastly contradictory ideas. We want our chosen one to offer stability, safety, predictability, and dependability, and want that same person to supply awe, mystery, adventure, and risk. So what is the solution? How can we commit to one another without losing ourselves in trying to meet these vast expectations? How can we be a fulfilling partnership that also helps us grow as individuals? Here's a place to start. We can think more clearly about our expectations from a partner. Research shows that people who have more social resources and more people to talk to about various issues in their lives do better in marriage. So, in what areas do we want to invest in our partners, and which areas do we want to invest in ourselves and our personal networks? And once we've had a chance to think more clearly about our expectations, how do we meet those expectations that we've set for ourselves and our relationships? We can stop thinking of love, desire, and relationships as commodities. They are not. When a jacket doesn't meet our expectations, we can easily purchase another. This is not the same true about our relationship. We have to work to make our expectations come to reality, and setting expectations is only the start. The next step is actually go about achieving them by investing the time, patience, and space necessary with our partners. The process might not be perfect, but aside from the moment we cite them, neither are our vows. So in closing, I'll leave you with the following scriptures from the Bible regarding the importance of community and relationships. At Proverbs 11:14, it states, "Where there is no counsel, the people fall, but in a multitude of counselors there is safety." And last, Ecclesiastes 4, verses 9 through 10 states, "Two are better than one because they have good reward for their labor. Moreover, if one of them falls down, one can help the other up." I am Nicole, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I wish you all the best in forming relationships as well as strengthening them. Thank you for listening. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This program is now available as a podcast on our website, NorthCarolinaReadingService.org. So long, and until the next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.